Coming up on the show today, a deal has been reached in the Israel-Hamas conflict.
It's expected 50 hostages will be released in stages in exchange for what Hamas says would be 150 Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. Both sides will release women and children first.
Plus, an Israeli journalist looks to the future of Gaza.
We can defeat Hamas, but we can't eliminate them. I think that Hamas, it's an ideological movement. An ideological movement you can destroy.
And then, the latest from Kyiv and North Korea, again violating UN resolutions, launches a spy satellite. Today is Wednesday, November 22nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. A deal has been reached. In an agreement negotiated by Qatar, Israel and Hamas have agreed that Hamas will release 50 of the hostages taken on October 7th in exchange for 150 Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. All of this will happen during a four-day pause in the fighting that will also allow for more distribution of humanitarian aid in the Gaza Strip. For more, here's Charles de Ledesma.
Israel and Hamas have reached an agreement for a four-day halt to the war in Gaza and the release of dozens of hostages held by the militant group as well as Palestinian prisoners. The truce marks the biggest diplomatic breakthrough since Hamas's October 7 rampage into southern Israel ignited the deadliest round of Israeli-Palestinian violence in decades. Qatar, which mediates with Hamas, announced the truce without saying when it would begin. It's expected 50 hostages will be released in stages in exchange for what Hamas says would be 150 Palestinian prisoners held by Israel. Both sides will release women and children first, and the supply of humanitarian aid flowing into the besieged territory will be ramped up. The announcements capped weeks of indirect Qatari-led negotiations between Israel and Hamas. The US and Egypt were also involved in stop-and-go talks to free some of the roughly 240 hostages. President Joe Biden has welcomed the deal, saying Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has committed to supporting an extended pause to make sure that the hostages are released and humanitarian aid can be sent to Gaza. Qatar's Prime Minister and top diplomat Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman adds he hopes the deal would eventually lead to a permanent ceasefire and serious talks on resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
As we've heard, after weeks of intense negotiation, a deal has been reached. For reaction inside Israel, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein.
I think people are still nervous. You know, it hasn't happened yet. And they, you know, for families of hostages, you know, who's included, who's not included. This first group of 50 who will be released over 4 days includes 30 children, some of their mothers, and another 12 women. Now, Israel says that there were 40 children who were kidnapped by Hamas and wants to know where the other 10 children are. Hamas says that it believes they're being held by Islamic Jihad and other places and will, during the ceasefire, try to find them and get them and, you know, for a possible future ceasefire. But I think there's still a lot of nervousness by the families. There's concern also that in this 4 days, then Hamas will use that time to rearm. Israel has said it will allow in large amounts of humanitarian aid, including fuel. But Israel also says that after that ceasefire ends, it's going back to fighting. So, you know, the fighting, you know, the families of the hostages are worried that it could endanger them. So I think basically there's nervousness and a little bit of hope.
I understand there's also a group in Israel opposed to the deal. They're suing to stop the release of the Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails.
Yes. So part of the deal is that Israel will release 150 Palestinian prisoners, women and men under the age of 19. who had been convicted of various crimes against Israel. Nobody who murdered Israelis will be released, but there is a group trying to stop it. It doesn't seem likely that they will succeed. Also, in Israel's cabinet vote last night, which approved the deal, one of the more hardline parties voted against it, saying that they thought that releasing the prisoners and allowing large amounts of humanitarian aid into Gaza is a mistake.
Now, famously, one of the men who is a leader of Hamas now, Yahya Sinwar, was released in a similar prisoner exchange. Are they nervous that something like that could happen again? Someone they release could come back and turn on Israel again?
Yes, although in that case, it was in exchange for the release of one Israeli soldier. More than 1,000 Hamas prisoners were released, including people who had been convicted of murder. In this case, it's teenagers and women. So I don't think there's necessarily fear that in this first hostage exchange, it could happen. But the Palestinians in the past, Hamas has said it wants the release of all Palestinians in Israeli jails, which would, of course, include murderers for the release of all of the hostages. So who's not being released tomorrow or in the near future are Israeli soldiers, both male and female, and any of the men. So it also means that there are whole families who were kidnapped by Hamas on October 7th, where now the mother and the children will get out and the father will stay behind in captivity.
Heartbreaking as that is, this is a step forward. Is there some relief?
Yes. I think there's some sense of relief, although, again, we're only talking about 50 people here out of 240 that Hamas kidnapped. So, yes, there is a sense of relief, but there's also a sense that the public thinks that Israel should continue with its goal of making sure that Hamas can never have military power again. And so there's some concern that after 4 days of ceasefire, there will be so much international pressure on Israel to stop the fighting that eventually Hamas will be able to rearm and be able to fight Israel again. So I think there is relief, but there is also quite a bit of concern. And there's a lot of uncertainty about what happens now. In other words, what happens after 4 days? You know, Palestinians say over 14,000 people have been killed in Gaza, two-thirds of them women and children. Northern Gaza has been completely destroyed. What's going to happen when the fighting ends? What happens to all of the people who've been displaced within Gaza? So I think there's a lot of questions. And at the same time, of course, there is relief. And for the families, you know, who haven't seen their loved ones since October 7th, of course, it will be a day of celebration.
That's VOA's Linda Gradstein joining me from Jerusalem. Now, we understand this to be a conflict between Israel and Hamas, not between Israel and all of the Palestinian people. Even so, many Palestinian citizens who are not part of Hamas, many who want peace, have been killed, injured, or have had their homes and cities destroyed. What does this conflict, this war, mean for them? What's the future of Hamas in Gaza when this is all behind us? For more than three decades, Israeli media personality Shlomi Eldar has been covering Hamas and Gaza. In his books and award-winning documentaries, he's tried to tell the stories of the Palestinians beyond the wall. Natasha Mozgovaya spoke with him in Israel.
I followed Hamas for over 13 years. I've never imagined to myself that Hamas became monsters. I had interviewed Ismail Haniyeh, the head of the Hamas movement, many times. I met many of the Hamas leaders over the years. I've never imagined that they could do something like we can, comparing to the Nazis, butchering, burning bodies, shooting them, rapes, kidnap children.
Shlomi Eldar, an Israeli author and documentary filmmaker who started covering Gaza in 1991, says Hamas was elected in 2006 in part in response to the perceived corruption of the Palestinian Authority and because of Hamas' welfare work with the people in the Gaza Strip. He says Hamas has since neglected its responsibilities to the people, instead diverting resources from civilians and opting for violence.
they took them back 20 or 25 years back, and even more. And after this war, I don't know what would be in Gaza after this war, but I heard voices in Gaza now talking freely. What you've made for us, what you've done to us. And the first time that I recognize the kind of demonstration against the Hamas movement.
He thinks the exceptional cruelty of the October 7 attack came about through a combination of factors. One of them is Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas leader in Gaza.
He was released in 2011, the prisoner exchange of Gilad Shamit, and Israel released him to Gaza. He's a cool man. I've heard many stories now because no one knows about him. He was rearrested in 1989 because he butchered Palestinians. He suspected them they are collaborating with Israel, and he just tortured them and killed them.
The second factor, he says, is an education in violence.
The new generation, the young people, they were born or they were children when Hamas took a power in Gaza Strip after the military coup. Maybe they were children 5, 6, 10 years old, and they grew up with incitement all the time. They even been taught that the Israelis are not human beings.
Israel declared the end of Hamas as the main goal of its military campaign in Gaza.
We can defeat Hamas, but we can't eliminate them. I think that Hamas, it's an ideological movement. An ideological movement you can destroy.
Eldar says he also knows Palestinians in Gaza who mourn the loss of the possibility of a Palestinian state and a peaceful coexistence with Israel.
I have a friend in Gaza Strip that I'm calling him every day. He's now in Rafah, hiding from the war. And he told me I left my house in Jabalia refugee camp, and I was crying. I didn't cry because I left my house, but because my dream is broken. We had a dream. We had a dream to build a state, to have a relationship with the Israelis. Now came Hamas, have killed everything.
He says the recovery of Gaza may take decades, and he is not sure if the border with Israel will ever reopen. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Israel.
We're off to Kyiv in a few minutes, but first to Africa. The war between Israel and Hamas has had political ramifications all over the world. In South Africa, the largest opposition party and the main Jewish representative body have both slammed Parliament's decision to cut diplomatic ties with Israel. Kate Bartlett has the story.
During a heated session in South Africa's parliament on Tuesday, all members of the governing African National Congress, which has a long history of solidarity with the Palestinians, voted in favor of cutting ties with Israel. Many wore Palestinian scarves and burst into song after the motion, originally brought by radical opposition party the Economic Freedom Fighters, passed. The vote is non-binding, but it is now up to the government to decide whether to act on the motion. President Cyril Ramaphosa's spokesman, Vincent Magwenya, read a statement.
The president notes and appreciates Parliament's guidance on our diplomatic relations with Israel, particularly with respect to the status of the Israeli embassy in South Africa. President Ramaphosa and cabinet are engaged over the matter, which remains the responsibility of the national executive.
On the day of the vote, Ramaphosa chaired a virtual meeting of leaders of the BRICS group of developing nations, which include Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, on the situation in the Middle East. At the BRICS meeting, Chinese President Xi Jinping described Israeli actions as collective punishment of people in Gaza, with Ramaphosa going further.
The deliberate denial of medicine, fuel, food, and water to the residents of Gaza is tantamount to genocide.
South Africa's main opposition, the Democratic Alliance, voted against the motion. Emma Powell, Shadow Minister for International Relations and Cooperation, warned afterwards that cutting ties would leave thousands of South Africans in Israel without access to emergency consular services and affect South Africa's representative office in Ramallah.
The ANC have rendered our own citizens entirely trapped with no way of accessing diplomatic assistance from their government.
The Israeli embassy in Pretoria was not available for comment. Israel's ambassador was recalled to Israel for consultations ahead of the parliamentary vote. However, Mary Cluck, vice president of the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, an umbrella organization representing the country's sizable Jewish community, deplored parliament's decision.
This vote had nothing to do with peace, and it was confirmed for me when I was watching on television the chanting of From the River to the Sea, a clear call for the destruction of the Jewish state.
South Africa recently referred Israel to the International Criminal Court for potential war crimes in Gaza. Israel says it is acting in self-defense after gunmen with the militant group Hamas killed an estimated 1,200 people on October 7th in the deadliest single attack on Israeli civilians in the history of the State of Israel. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The potential for a new global crisis in Asia coming up. First, though, we check in on things in Ukraine. Ukraine and Russia are each facing difficulties in the eastern and southern front lines as heavy battles continue. Meanwhile, the city of Kyiv is covered with the first snow of 2023. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the details.
Ukrainian air forces reported the destruction of all 14 of the Shahed drones that Russia used to shell Ukraine before dawn on November 22nd. Critical infrastructure in the western regions of Ukraine was the main target. However, the air raid alarm also went off in the central, northern, southern, and eastern regions. Meanwhile, Ukrainian troops struck a gathering of Russian soldiers in the Donetsk region when Russian servicemen were being awarded medals for the occasion of the Missile Forces Day celebration on November 19th. Russian media confirmed the attack. On the evening of November 22nd, the ground forces of Ukraine published a video which purportedly recorded the moment of the attack. The situation in Avdiivka remains difficult. Ukrainian forces continue their attempts to counter-attack and hold defensive positions while Russian forces increase their ground forces operations. At the same time, Ukrainian armed forces reported that Russian forces have increased the number of assaults and airstrikes, dropping anti-aircraft missiles with the Su-35 jets in the southeastern direction. British intelligence reports that the battles on the eastern bank of the Dnipro River in the Kherson region are extremely unpleasant for the Russian army, as they are characterized by confusing, chaotic infantry clashes and artillery firefights in difficult wooded terrain. British analysts stated that Ukrainian marines maintain a bridgehead in that area. The day before, the British Minister of Defense noted that the Russian Federation had accumulated significant reserves of cruise missiles ahead of winter. Meanwhile, Ukrainians are getting ready for the second tough winter facing Russian attacks, with the first snow of 2023 covering the capital city Kyiv on November 22nd. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
We heard on Tuesday's show about the November 21st anniversary of the start of the uprising known as Maidan, or the Revolution of Dignity in Ukraine. Today, we'll meet some of the participants. The wave of civil unrest was sparked by the Russian-backed president, Viktor Yanukovych's decision not to sign an association agreement with the European Union, which set off a three-month resistance movement. VOA met with three Maidan activists whose lives, along with their country, changed forever in November of 2013.
The demonstration in Kyiv's main square, Maidan Nezalezhnosti, started when then-President Yanukovych declined to sign a pact with the European Union, instead choosing closer ties to Russia. Yuli Terekhov was a student back then. In the early morning of November 30, 2013, he was at the center of Maidan Square when Ukrainian riot police violently clamped down on the protesters. Yuli Terekhov, a Maidan activist, remembers that he didn't think he would have so many consequences from the beating. But he says that when he looked in the mirror, he saw that half of his back was bruised. The violent dispersal of protesters sparked even more demonstrations that lasted for 3 months with hundreds of victims. Activist Yuli Terekhov shows the place where he got a concussion in a confrontation with Yanukovych's riot police. Yuli was in Maidan Square the whole time, and the revolution marked him forever. Protesters claimed victory for their revolution when President Yanukovych fled the city. But their triumph was followed by the Russia's annexation of Crimea and later the start of the Russian-Ukrainian war in the east of the country. All of it changed Yuli's plans. Terekhov recalls that he wanted to become a famous DJ and write electronic dance music, but he says the war in the East started and he joined the military along with others his age. Yuli is a captain in the Ukrainian armed forces now. Maidan changed the life of Oksana Sivak too. At the time, she worked as a gynecologist and went to Maidan to treat sick and wounded protesters. Oksana Sivak says she and her friends put white t-shirts on top of their clothes and painted a cross with lipstick on them and went to the first barricade to treat the wounded. Oksana describes it as controlled chaos. Everyone, she says, somehow clearly understood who should do what. Oksana Sivak says they even have a schedule. She says doctors from Kyiv usually came to Maidan at night. Meanwhile, doctors from other cities took vacations in order to be in Maidan and were there during the day. After Maidan, Oksana left her medical practice and is now more involved in promoting medical legislation. Oksana Sivak says at the beginning of the full-scale invasion in 2022, they met the same group of friends that they had at Maidan. And she was surprised to see they were the same people. But her friends corrected her and said there were actually more of them because their children had grown up. Activists say the Maidan revolution is still going on for them as they battle Russia's assault on Ukraine's sovereignty and continue their fight for Western-style democratic reforms in their country. Lesya Bakalets, VOA News, Kyiv.
And finally today, in what has the potential to develop into another global crisis, North Korea said it successfully placed its first spy satellite into orbit late on Tuesday. The launch, in violation of UN sanctions, could give the North an unprecedented ability to monitor the U.S. and South Korean militaries, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un oversaw the Tuesday launch. State media says the spy satellite successfully reached orbit. Kim wants an array of spy satellites to monitor U.S. and allied troops in the region. But that will depend on the number and quality of images those satellites can produce. Earlier this year, South Korea's military recovered parts of a North Korean satellite that crashed into the sea. It said the device had no military utility. But that's debatable, says analyst Su Tianjian.
I think that even a satellite with rudimentary capabilities could still be a first step or modestly improve North Korea's situational awareness.
Though the Tuesday launch was expected, it prompted alerts and even brief evacuation warnings in southern Japan. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida condemned the move.
Even if the purpose is to launch a satellite, using ballistic missile technology is a clear violation of the relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions. It is also a very serious matter that greatly concerns the safety of our people.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is on a state visit to Britain. In response to the launch, Yoon approved the partial suspension of an inter-Korean military agreement. The 2018 agreement was signed during a period of rare diplomacy between the two Koreas. That diplomacy was short-lived. North Korea soon resumed its military provocations, including major weapons tests. More launches are on the way, and from the South Korean side. Later this month, South Korea plans to launch its first domestically built spy satellite using a SpaceX rocket. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.